Today's episode is the first of a three-part series we are going to do looking at what life might be like on colonies or colonial spaceships. We normally focus so much on the technology and mechanics of extraterrestrial colonies or ships that we mostly ignore what the day-to-day life would be like, and it seemed time to rectify that a bit. Now, there are a few reasons we have avoided this in the past. First, colony life is going to vary a lot on what technology is available. You don't need to have people growing food if you have robots who can do all the work, for instance. Second, we don't know what the people will be like, because it is entirely possible, even likely, that what passes for human on colonies would be a cyborg or genetically tweaked human or even an outright digital person. And third, we don't know how they'd behave because we don't know their motivations. If we are looking at day-to-day life and how the place governs itself, that would depend a lot on why those colonists decided to become colonists in the first place. Traditionally, it takes a lot of motivation to get people to up and leave their life behind, but what that motive is can be a lot different for each colony and each individual. We are going to try to set the stage for better considering what colony life would actually be like, and that means we will be spending a fair amount of time, especially in this first episode, still talking about a lot of the mechanics. Fortunately, we have discussed a lot of those in the past too, so I will occasionally reference those episodes to save time. When it comes to asking why we would colonize other places, what our motives will be, and how colonists might govern themselves, we will draw on some historical examples for insights. However, we also want to avoid letting ourselves be trapped in a box by history. While I can empathize with King Solomon's word-wary assertion that there is nothing new under the sun, I don't think anyone alive today can take that comment as true at face value. There are just too many changes to our civilization in terms of technology, culture, and day-to-day life to think we can treat any historic event as a strong guide to future events. So while we will draw on a lot of historical examples of previous colonies in this and follow-up episodes, we will also try to look for parallels in modern times and take both with a sizable grain of salt. To truly explore this topic, there are some questions we need to ask ourselves about any given colony and any given colonist. Here are some of the most important questions we should be thinking about for our colony itself. Number 1. What is its purpose? Number 2. Who is founding it and why? Number 3. Where is it relative to the Earth and Sun? Number 4. How big is the object being settled? Number 5. What are the object's characteristics? So what is its purpose? Is it a scientific outpost? Is it a money-making one? Mining for platinum or growing food or building ships? Is it a national extension? Something fully backed and supported by a country getting its footholds in space? Maybe it is a religious or ideological one. It could have more than one purpose too, and almost certainly will have at least secondary goals. That will depend a lot on who is founding it and why. If I am part of a religious denomination that puts a lot of value on farming, I might decide to found an agricultural colony. So my motive is principally religious, but it is also presumably a money-making one focused on exporting food. Needless to say, that is going to dominate where I want to put it, since you need sunlight to grow food, and you need people to buy that food. So where the colony is, relative to the Earth and Sun, matters a lot, even if you've got cheap fusion to use instead of sunlight. It will also control the time lag on all communications, which also means a longer response time for any problem where you need export help from back home. Also, the further out you are, the more isolated your colony is, and the more expensive it will be to set the colony up or import replacement components and consumables. On the other hand, if I'm from a religious or ideological group that is very isolationist and doesn't want to be around bad influences, the further and deeper out in space, the better. We also need to know how big the object is. Is it a planet, a large moon, an asteroid, or comet? This controls some of our ultimate ends for that colony. A Martian colony might want to take some steps to accustom people to lower gravity, genetic engineering perhaps, while ironically, places with lower gravity probably would not. Mars has enough gravity to hold an atmosphere too, and a roughly Earth-length day, so that they might seriously consider full-blown terraforming of that planet. Alternatively, your average asteroid that is only a few kilometers across, and even most moons and comets, are better thought of as an egg you plan to grow inside and eventually hatch out of, into a colony far bigger than that asteroid was when you started. This will depend on what the other characteristics of the object are. What is it made of? Is it high in metals? Is it high in organic elements? Is it drifting by itself, or in a large group of other bodies, like a collection of moons? Next, we need to ask why any given colonist would want to become a colonist. If we want to know what life would be like on one, that depends a lot on physical characteristics of the colony, in terms of the resources it has and technology available. It also depends on the motivations and goals of the colonists, both as individuals and as a group. It is pretty normal, for instance, for a young couple to become colonists, and they may already have children too. Either way, odds are one of them is more enthusiastic about it than the other. So you could easily end up with half of your colonists there who are a bit lukewarm about it. That can change with time, too. I can think of any number of trips I made or events I attended at the insistence of friends who were very excited about it, where I turned out to have a great time and sometimes they felt disappointed afterwards. In any given colony, you should expect a broad spectrum of motives, goals, and personalities, depending on how strict your recruitment guidelines are and how good you are at screening for those desired traits, of course. I also want to emphasize that when I say colony, I mean a place where people plan to set up shop for the long term and have families. Now, it might be a dedicated zero-growth place that plans to begin at 1,000 people and stay that way till the end of time, or their idea of family might differ a lot from our own, like if they grew their new people in tanks till adulthood. But I'd still call those colonies. The motives of the colony overall, and individually, will control a lot of how it grows and functions. One started by a group of anarchists and one started as a Marxist commune are going to have very different priorities from each other and won't be like one meant to be a Catholic colony. I don't want to oversimplify any of those groups and their goals, but the anarchist group would probably want to emphasize individual homes more than the commune in their first construction, while the Catholics might want their first building to be a large church everyone could take their meals and sleep in while homes were built. Some folks might just be there to make money and plan to leave, and that could include a lot of senior colony personnel like the doctor or lawyer or administrative specialist who isn't even interested in the goal of the colony, just doing their job there until their contract expires or they get promoted to a position elsewhere. So the motives control why people are establishing a colony and will tell us at least as much about life on that colony as what technology we have. But there are also certain categories of objects for colonization we need to consider too. When it comes to categorization, there are tons, but we have three major ones we need to consider. How big is the object being colonized? How close is it to the sun? And how close is it to other objects? But let's discuss that last one first. Things are very different if you've got one rock, all alone, billions of miles from its neighbors, as opposed to a small collection of asteroids or moons, all close enough you could have a real-time telephone conversation. It also controls how self-sufficient you need to be, since not only do communications travel slower, but trade will take longer too. This would also cost more in terms of actual cost and lost time. You also might not want to pick a cluster of asteroids, even if the others were uninhabited at that time. A body 10 kilometers across has about the same mass and resources as 8 bodies half as wide, 5 kilometers across. But it is probably easier to make sure your colony has a sole claim on that one body than all eight, and you might not want neighbors. As to how big the object is, I've decided to break everything into just six sizes. Less than a kilometer across, less than 10 kilometers across, less than 100, less than 1,000, less than 10,000, and less than 100,000. And I'll call those 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, respectively. We could imagine a Category 6, but only Jupiter itself would be that big, as would brown dwarfs. And today, we're not interested in any of our gas giants, except their moons, though we may look at colonizing them directly in the future. Now, this is a measure of diameter by order of magnitude, so it is a bit arbitrary, but in a raw sense, each category is 10 times wider, but also 1,000 times more massive than the last, and so could presumably support 1,000 times the population. Now, I also picked these to highlight the importance of gravity. Almost every celestial object you probably know the name of is Category 4 or 5. Earth, Venus, and all the gas giants except Jupiter are 5s. These are also the only places you could expect to find gravity comfortable and not need to worry about health issues. These also have no problem holding an atmosphere. When you get down to Category 4, though, these are the objects that are where classic terraforming is probably possible, but will take a lot of work, probably including some genetic engineering or such, to make animals and people safe against the ailments we associate to low gravity. Though I should note, we don't know for sure what those are. We know what zero gravity or microgravity does to the body, but we genuinely do not know how much gravity would be needed to avoid or mitigate those effects. Mars and Mercury, for instance, at the high end of Category 4, might be just fine on their own. On the same note, most of these objects could hoard an atmosphere if you were willing to work to maintain it. This category includes Mars, Mercury, Pluto, and all the other dwarf planets, and the 16 biggest moons in the solar system, including our own. Let me qualify that. It technically would not include Ceres, the largest asteroid or closest dwarf planet to the Sun, which is just under 1,000 kilometers, and the only asteroid in the belt with a real claim on dwarf planet status. And some of the other dwarf planet candidates come in at 900 kilometers or so. I will include those in Category 4 just so we can say all the categories below this are those where the objects are now only spherical from general coincidence, not gravity. Nothing below this category can be expected to have reasonably uniform gravity over the entire surface, or not cause serious low gravity issues, or hold an atmosphere without a dome over it. On any of these places, you could expect to discharge a pistol and have the bullet land on the ground eventually. Beneath this category, it would go flying off into space. A couple of notes. First, if you add up all the Category 4, 5, and 6 objects in the solar system, and probably most other solar systems, you won't get into triple digits. There's about 30 such objects in our solar system. On the other hand, there are about 200 countries on this planet, and several times that number if we included every subdivision, ethnicity, religion, or ideology big enough to count as its own country. The sorts of places or groups who could get their hands on $1 billion if they need to. You don't necessarily need to be a country to have a colony. Now, those 30 objects aren't enough for everyone to have one of their own, which is okay, because those places could all host dozens or even thousands of unique colonies, and they could come from any number of nations or groups. But it would be hard for one nation back here to just claim total ownership of, say, Mars. So the smaller objects, the Category 3 kind, the ones between 100 and 1,000 kilometers in radius, get a lot more tempting. At least if you want one rock of your own, because there are a few hundred of those in the solar system, so you could start thinking about making a singular claim on one of those. When we get to Category 2, 10 to 100 kilometers across, There's several thousand of those just in the asteroid belt alone, and many thousands of others. And it is easy to forget that any one of those could easily be turned into a place that could comfortably house an entire planetary population. I'll explain that in a bit. But there's enough of them that anybody with the resources to be thinking about having a colony could stake a singular claim to at least one. Now, these can't be classically terraformed, but we'll get to that in a bit, too. Your Category 1 objects, 1 to 10 kilometers, are also quite attractive objects, being the size of a mountain or metropolis, and numbering in the hundreds of thousands just in the asteroid belt alone. There's probably many millions further out when we throw in comets, Kuiper belt objects, and the stuff out in the Oort cloud. These are also great colony prospects, because as we'll see, they could be transformed into places that would be nice-sized countries in their own right. Even our Category 0 objects, those less than a kilometer across, make for nice colonies if you are only trying to make something that could support a fairly decent-sized community that was fairly self-sufficient. These sizes also tell us a lot about how stuff reaches the colony and where people live. Category 4 objects mostly don't have atmospheres, but can maybe have them, and can also have space elevators on them that don't need to be made out of supermaterials. Beneath this, while space elevators can still work in some cases, they mostly don't serve any purpose. Ships just land and take off, and in a lot of cases can do so with virtually no fuel expenditure, or even no fuel expenditure. Many would be able to get away with having a runway where a magnet or tow cable just dragged them up to speed, or where they literally just collided with a spring, or the colony just snagged them with a magnet on a tether and slowly halted them and reeled them in. That changes the game a lot, especially in a place like the asteroid belt, which while nowhere near as dense as fiction often portrays it, could easily have the equivalent to passenger planes or buses, or even cars, that just went back and forth to nearby asteroids. You could even have individual asteroid homes, small village equivalents, or even single-family residences people could essentially drive to the bigger asteroids from. A 100-meter-wide asteroid, a Category -1 I suppose, would be nice for this purpose, and there are tens of millions of those in the belt. Now, they are separated by hundreds of thousands of miles from each other, but that's maybe a day of travel tops, and what's more, it's only seconds of light lag on any communication. Plus, you can just move one. I mean, we've talked about moving whole solar systems and even galaxies on this channel. Moving a rock the size of a mansion through the void of space to be a million kilometers closer to a bigger asteroid colony barely even qualifies as a task. So you could just shove your asteroid to 100 kilometers away from some Category 2 or 3 asteroid and fly over to it to go shopping. We've talked before about hollowing out asteroids and slowly disassembling them to reassemble them as megastructures, but you can also latch them together quite easily. The gravitational force between two asteroids in the 10 kilometer diameter range, say 20 kilometers apart, is low enough you wouldn't even have to mess around with putting them into orbit of each other. You could literally hold them apart with a rigid metal shaft, a decently thick and sturdy one, but nothing requiring massive feats of engineering or super science. You could even snatch smaller asteroids with a fairly long tether and reel them in. We'll come back to this stuff in a bit, but let us address our other category type first, distance from the Sun. Now I say distance from the Sun, but I also mean Earth. Except for Mercury and Venus, and maybe Mars and the near-Earth asteroids, this is essentially the same thing. We discussed the inner and outer solar system recently, breaking them at the asteroid belt, but I want to break into five more distinct categories today: inner, middle, outer, deep, and extrasolar. Here I will be considering inner to be any place as close to the Sun as Earth or closer. Of natural objects, that is Mercury, Venus, Earth, the Moon, and the near-Earth asteroids. But as those of you familiar with the channel know, we would often be thinking about making artificial habitats all over this volume as a build-up to a Dyson swarm. Here, light is not only more than abundant enough to grow plants and use as solar power, which is great in space since there's no nighttime or clouds, but actually can be so abundant you might need to take steps to block it. The inner region is also where communications are fast. Not only is there likely to be plenty of people living within a real-time communication distance with you, where a phone call might just feel a little slow, but you can talk to anyone in the inner region within minutes, not hours. Even a call to the other side of the inner region and the return time on an answer is only half an hour. I will count Mars and the asteroid belt as the middle solar system, and also Jupiter, its moons, and Trojan asteroids. This is the region where there's not a lot of sunlight, but it is still plentiful enough to either grow plants and use with solar panels, or at least wouldn't need much augmentation. Out past Jupiter, as I've mentioned before, solar is still an option, but not a very good one. Everything has to be scaled up massively to acquire and concentrate the kind of power you need. Technically, you can live on solar power anywhere in the galaxy or even the universe, since there is a decent amount of ambient light. But even ignoring that you would need panel and mirror arrays the size of a football stadium to power a light bulb, you have to consider the sheer construction and maintenance costs compared to just buying some uranium to run a fission plant. It is still semi-viable in the outer region, which I consider to be from Saturn out through the Kuiper Belt. But these are not places for serious colonization until you have fusion or can at least have huge solar arrays near the sun beaming energy out to the colonies. So out in this region, with the exception of a couple of the larger moons, surface habitation is just pointless. It exposes you to radiation and micrometeors. But the sun is still bright enough you could comfortably walk around without a flashlight during the day. Type 4, deep space, out past the Kuiper Belt, is where space is incredibly uncomfortable and totally your enemy. There's no point having anything on the surface of whatever ice ball you settled, besides your landing spots, which would probably have retractable armored shuttles over them, and your transmitters and receivers, and maybe an observation dome or two, because the night sky is likely to be a rather pleasant sight out there. You could conceivably still use solar by beamed energy out here. That's actually a cheap trick for moving comets into the solar system. You coat one side with solar panels and beam energy to it to power an ion thruster that uses some of the ice as propellant. Fission remains possible too, but I just don't see the point. You might get a colony or two out there just to prove it could be done, but nobody would develop this region seriously until fusion was cheap and easy, in which case every object out there looks like a giant tank of gasoline. As to our last category, extrasolar, that will be our topic for our third video, though it could technically include stuff that was so far out it didn't count as part of our solar system anymore. Those are the same as deep space habitats for all practical purposes, though. Now, before we abandon talking about solar power entirely as an option, I did want to bring up a slight addendum to something I called a mushroom habitat. We introduced those when discussing Mercury in the two-parter with Fraser Cain a few weeks back, and I should probably note I coined that term, though I'm sure someone came up with the concept before. One of the things about futurism is you do have to coin terms sometimes, and you just cross your fingers if you come up with a bad or silly one that someone renames it. The funny thing is that the idea started backwards. The Mercury version is meant to shield you from sunlight, and that trick works on habitats near the sun too, if you need a place for people to live who are tending to massive solar arrays placed as close to the sun as they can be without melting. Simple setup. Mushroom side turned toward the sun to block light, reflective surface to bounce most of it away. But my original version was backwards for deeper out in space. Big rotating cylinder habitat at the stem, out where the sun is getting a bit weak for use, and behind it is the mushroom cap as a parabolic dish reflecting in concentrated sunlight. So if solar is your power source, you would expect an awful lot of the asteroid, small moon, or free-floating habitats to use this scheme out in the middle regions past Earth out to Jupiter, and maybe further too. I should probably have just called those a parabolic dish habitat, but mushroom sounds neater. It's also a great setup to receive beamed power further out if you need to go that route. So figure on anything past Mars using this sort of setup if they have not got fusion. Beyond things like that, except for those 30 or so objects which might have enough gravity or might be augmented by combining spin gravity and local gravity, the colonies ought to look a lot alike. Everybody lives inside. We have talked about rotating habitats more times than I can count, so I won't go over that again. Of course, you do always have the option of either non-uniform gravity by not making your cylinder radially symmetric, like a pair of connected cones instead, or just telling gravity to take a hike and just taking whatever measures are necessary to make your population and attached flora and fauna able to survive in microgravity. You can combine rotating habitats and zero-gravity environments too. In fact, the easiest way to connect rotating habitats is with hubs that don't have gravity, which would let you produce huge networks of cylinder habitats in two or three dimensions. You would probably expand into your asteroid by making more cylinders inside and take excess material to cover over ones built outside it as protective shielding or shipped off as exports for trade. This is what I meant about being able to turn a Category 3 object into something that could hold an entire planetary population. Even just a hollowed-out asteroid packed with cylinders is going to be vastly larger in living area than the surface of that asteroid was. But you can build outward too, taking that hollowed-out material and basically dumping it around the outside of a big balloon you just inflated as needed until all the matter was either in the cylinders or in that outer shell. You could cannibalize that too, and just replace it with a layer of compressed hydrogen or something. Hydrogen is great at blocking radiation, incredibly abundant, and the fuel for fusion anyway. That's way down the line though, not technologically, just that it would take centuries before we would fill up all the normal, unmodified rocks. There's no hard and fast rule about how thick the floor should be on a rotating habitat, especially since you can do multiple levels, but I usually just use a ton per square meter as a ballpark figure. In that context, a 10-kilometer wide asteroid, the cutoff between Category 2 and 3, masses out at about a trillion tons, and so a trillion square meters, or a million square kilometers, about the size of Egypt, or 5 times larger than Great Britain. The 100-kilometer wide kind at the cutoff of Category 3 and 4 would have 1,000 times the mass, and thus 1,000 times the area, which would be about 2 Earths worth, including the oceans and ice caps. And there are hundreds of these, and many thousands of the smaller kind. Lots of room to grow. But how big should you start? Bigger is better when it comes to founding a colony. The more the better, because it allows more specialization and self-sufficiency. For instance, if I want to have a court, any kind of court, I need at least 3 lawyers in my colony, a judge and an advocate for both sides. Realistically, I need 4 to handle conflicts of interest and to give a defendant at least some choice in who defends them. That would mean 4% of your population would be lawyers in a colony of 100 people. The norm is more like a tenth of that, and that would mean a population of 1,000 people to support 4 of them at the normal distribution. Now, you don't necessarily need courts on a colony, and it doesn't necessarily have to be their full-time job, but that won't be the only profession like that. There are a lot of specialist areas you can do without, like an insurance salesman, because you could source that from home. Ditto, a neurologist is better in person, but he could do a decent job remotely by analyzing scans and diagnoses taken by a general practitioner on site. There are a lot of other things you do need on site though, things that also take a ton of training, like a veterinarian, or nurse, or surgeon, or dentist. Also, after the initial colonies, you have a recruitment problem. When you have something as prestigious as one of the first colonies, and when you have tens of thousands of possible candidates for each specialty, you can find yourself a person with three or four of the necessary specializations, and who doesn't mind doing one that is kind of grubby. I have difficulty seeing a colony of less than 100 people, and I think 1,000 is a lot more reasonable for anything that does not allow near real-time communication with Earth. When we talk about extrasolar colonies, though, I'd be thinking more like tens of thousands, because while you can bring all the knowledge of Earth with you on data storage, that does not equate to expertise, and there's nobody to call on for help. Though for all of these cases, you need to consider the impact of things like transhumans. People who have had their intelligence amped up can learn faster. People who live a lot longer than now can absorb more specialties. And it implies access to a lot of automation that lets you save your people for mostly mental work, some or all of which might be doable by artificial intelligence too. Talking about lawyers and courts brings up the idea of how you administrate your colony. We will save the case of total independence for episode 3 since, barring us figuring out how to cheat the speed of light, those have to operate totally independently from day one. I am also not interested in discussing the notion of rebellion and succession. We already have tons of examples of that in history, and each occasion tends to be somewhat unique. I generally tend to assume most colonies in the solar system will be under some existing nation, even if it is nearly autonomous and basically just has a deal cut with some nation to represent their interests at home, like some minor but stable nation back on Earth agrees to act as the intermediary where diplomacy is concerned in exchange for you landing your goods at their space dock. Interests back home are worth remembering too. Not all of a colony is going to be actually at the colony. Some might follow along later as the infrastructure allows more to come, or just support the idea enthusiastically but not want to go themselves. I remember in one of David Weber's books, it is mentioned that the colony that founded the protagonist's home system of Manticore had intentionally left funds behind on Earth in an administered trust fund, building up compound interest so they had resources back on Earth to buy new technologies or pay for colonists' passage fees. The author remarked there that it was something few other colonies had thought to do, but I took that as a bit of a poke at a lot of other science fiction, where such an obvious good idea never gets mentioned and presumably wasn't thought of. Of course, a colony would have a law firm back on Earth watching their interests. Of course, they would have a lot of consulting groups they could call on to serve as the crisis team when things go wrong, like NASA Mission Control does now. The fusion reactor broke. The spare component has been used. You are a year from the nearest place that can send you one. It is handy to have some folks back on Earth who can take an inventory of everything you've got and MacGyver up a functional spare. Even if you are a colony that is specifically looking to get away from Earth cultures and somehow brought everyone with you rather than just an initial team funded and supplied by a larger group back home, there'd probably be plenty of firms that would become specialists in the necessary issues colonies tended to face. As to what government people would use, we just don't know. Frankly, I consider it kind of absurd to ask that anyway for two reasons. First, I doubt everyone would use the same kind. And second, I am strongly of the opinion that whatever kind they use is their decision at that time, which means it will change as the colony ages too. It is a very popular topic when colonization comes up, and we will talk about it more in episode 3. But in my experience, if you ask 10 people, every one will give a different answer, and half of them will be completely convinced almost every colony will use one specific approach to self-governance, which just happens to correspond to their own idea of utopia. Their confidence in this will not be one bit shaken by everyone disagreeing with them or noticing a few of the other folks are just as confident with their own entirely different vision of how things can and indeed must be. So what is day-to-day life on the colony like? The simple answers are we don't know, because it would depend way too much on the colony's purpose, the reason it was founded, and the technologies available. What we've been doing today is trying to set the background for people to consider this themselves. The other simple answer is probably a lot like now in many ways. I mean, my day-to-day life is almost certainly very different from yours and every other person on this channel. We have our work, our family and friends, and our hobbies. We juggle them to get them done the best we can, and it often involves unpleasant parts even if we mostly enjoy it. Now we have a bit of a better picture about what those colonies are going to be like in order to consider that idea. But in the end, much like now, we can only take that so far because it is too broad a concept that is going to vary too much. Life for a mining engineer on Ganymede just won't be much like the life of a doctor on an orbital farm near Earth, or his like that of a surgeon who serves at a hub for a lot of smaller colonies. We will look a bit more into the day-to-day tasks in the next two episodes, now that we've got more of the basics in place. Speaking of that, in next week's episode, we will be looking both at interstellar colony ships, often called generation ships and arc ships, as well as at interplanetary colony ships. Frequently, you will actually use your ship directly as your forced colonial structure, so it is worth examining. We will also talk about some of the crew concepts, daily chores, and also how we might select candidates for colonies during recruitment. In the third episode, we will cover a lot of the topics we had to bypass today. But our big focus will be on that first interstellar colony, and in many ways, it will more closely resemble early interplanetary colonies. We sort of skipped those today to look at what colonies will be like when it's not a brand new and prestigious thing, because I wanted to save it for the more pioneering tone of an early extrasolar colony. If you want alerts when those and other videos come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to hit the like button, share it with others, and try out some of the other episodes on the channel. Until next time, thanks for watching, and have a great day.